I'm Mark Laberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy to me today to welcome Dr. Alexis Abernethy to be our guest on Conversing. Dr. Abernethy is professor of clinical psychology in the Department of Doctoral Psychology at Fuller, and she's also the chief of diversity, equity, and inclusion at Fuller. It's really been a long time that she's been on the faculty. She first joined the faculty in 1988. She had done degrees at Howard University and both her master's and her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. She brings a wealth of both personal experience, deep humility, deep integration of spirit, mind, and body, and a great colleague and friend in this work together. So, Dr. Abernethy, thank you so much for joining us. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you, President Laberton. It's wonderful to join you in this.
We haven't spoken in this kind of a context since this past summer unfolded with the death of George Floyd and so many other things that have occurred. So I'd like to just go back and have you just kind of recap. Take us through your experience of America in 2020, especially related to the way that the buildup following the start of the pandemic, then the buildup of all the additional layering of racial violence that occurred against Black bodies, and then the death of George Floyd and all of the demonstrations and protests that followed from that time. We'll pick it up eventually where we are now, but just walk us through that history as you look at it. And what did you notice? What stands out now in even this much distance?
Well, I have to kind of describe how I entered into 2020, because we had the opportunity at Fuller to view Phil Allen's film, Open Wounds. And I was invited to be a discussant for that. And what I found, this film depicts the murder of his grandfather and the cover-up related to that and the subsequent trauma. Well, my family's from South Carolina, part of my family, my mother's side. And so we would go there every year. So there's a way in which seeing the scenes, because he filmed it there in South Carolina, it brought and unearthed trauma for me. And so here I am viewing the film. I did preview it before the event, but then seeing it all together in the context of community, I found myself triggered. And what does that kind of mean? There are flashbacks. There are things that are coming in my mind that not even fully formed, but it was an identification with the horror of that that was unspoken. I don't have a trauma history other than racial trauma. But in that moment, I found myself wanting, I did have notes and, you know, research I wanted to cite, but I found myself going totally in my head. I mean, I am a relational person generally, but I just was trying to retreat to try to have some control. And I realized that that would be a horrible way of engaging with the ways in which Phil's telling his story and the familial effects and the relational pieces and the wonderful reconnecting with his father. But that's where I was. So there's a way in which I was frozen. So in that moment, I was still frozen. As I got before people, I said, I'm triggered. And of course, I know other people were as well. And then by sharing that and feeling a collective connection around that, I actually was able to move forward and then share some of the things and be in solidarity. So that's how I entered 2020. So then COVID comes. I'm in New York at a conference, probably one of the last conferences they could have had there early March. And, you know, we weren't thinking we needed to fully shut down at that point. Then I go to visit my mother in a nursing home. So all these concerns about my being safe, being sure she's safe. And then as the racial disparities were starting to become clear related to COVID. So first, our Asian brothers and sisters getting all of this harmful and even lives being lost and on the line related to people's biases and the way that was being expressed. Then as we did find out more about folks of African descent, it just was
so much more worrying for me personally, you know, for my mother, you know, nursing homes, the community, all of that. So I found myself going into, you know, May with those things quite loaded very fully for me. So then the murders and, of course, what was happening earlier to Breonna Taylor. And the thing that got me about this, these things happened earlier in the year and we did hardly know about it. So I found myself going from, you know, being angry to being sad to being in. And I used to do work with police officers. So I know that back in the 90s, we were training officers. The Rochester Police Department at that time was quite ahead. It's suffered some difficulties now, but we know what excessive use of force is. It's very clear. And those are all those examples we were seeing. But it was the, you know, all of those things were continually painful. But then to see the, I mean, how do I even describe it? The lack of concern, the boldness. You know, it's one thing to murder somebody, but to murder somebody in public, on the street, knowing that they're witnesses and that doesn't matter. There is a cruelty that... And I think that's what struck even those of us who've seen this in varying ways. But that, I think, is part of what quickened people and convicted people in certain way that maybe hadn't even really realized how
the sheer brazenness of it all.
Brazenness, exactly. That was just not one person doing that. The fact that he was able to do that, if you want to know what systemic racism looks like, and frankly, genocidal behavior looks like, that's what it looks like. And so there was a way that history from 1619 and before, that whole history was lived out in that moment. So I remember going to class. Remember, I was already, you know, in a space I'd never been before, triggered. So I knew I had to take some space. You know, Mark, we'd normally be in communication about these things. Okay, what's good of the public expression, all that? I was 4 days. I was just... I'm just trying to make it from day to day.
Right.
And I did call you that Friday, but it was like, and thank goodness things were moving forward. You were doing what you needed to do. But in class, what I remember that day, you know, and I'm teaching a small class, group oriented, and I didn't have the energy. You know, I do devotionals. We talk about COVID. I'm bringing all these issues, but it was too close that day. So I could not work with it. What was so beautiful, one of my students, and it wasn't a student of color, which was actually part of what made it beautiful. That student shared. Didn't share in the way of, are you okay, Dr. Abernathy? That would have been like five. But the first thing was, I am, she's saying, I am saddened. I am angered. There was a solidarity around that. And then that gave me room to say, yes, I'm so glad you were able to share this today. I was less able to. So, you know, then when we look at the things that have emerged, you know, from that, the mobilization, that's been so encouraging. And, you know, there's a truth to better late than never. Some of us are frustrated it's taken so long, but, you know, a movement that involves more people across the board, that is likely to result in change. So I've just been so encouraged by that. And, you know, the range, we know certain things are, you know, politicized. But the truth is, back in the 90s, the Rochester police were saying, we need to devote funding to mental health services, the different training. So taking funding away, let's call it that, from the traditional police activities toward other activities that will help support the police, these are actually things that police have been asking for. You know they need help and assistance, mental health and other kinds of assistance. So the fact that policy and procedural changes are occurring. We need the movement and the young folks. It's more than young folks, but I'm so appreciative of the Black Lives Matter movement and the mobilization that's going forward, but also the way that's translating into policies and procedures, because we need it all going on, laws, all of that. This is a full court press. And that has been so exciting to me. So even as I continue to cry and mourn and be angry as these things continue to happen, you know, Maya Angelou's words, give me strength and still I rise. This morning, what was the psalm? Was it Psalm 56? Mm-hmm. So in our prayer time, it was a reminder that battles are there. You know, sometimes you really feel like, Lord, can we stop? Can the fight, can that battle be over? And the Lord says, you know, battles are with us. I am in the midst of you in the battle, and I am with you in the battle. So the more that my strength comes from realizing my strength comes from his strength, the Lord gives me strength. The Lord gives us strength. He gives us wisdom, and he helps us know how we need to proceed. So I'm encouraged by all of those things, but let's be clear. The open season of expressing brutality has not ended. And words can be as brutal. They may not be as final, but they have negative health consequences. So that saddens me on a whole nother level now, because it's one thing to see people becoming more entrenched. So you see this movement occurring, and then you see this sense of being more entrenched. You know, so we had a conversation recently about this as Fuller faculty. And what the Lord brought to me the night before the election, the eve of the election, he said, daughter, you need to understand the actual theological, biblical perspective of someone that's diametrically opposed to you. You need to respect it. You do not agree with it, that's clear, but you need to understand that, because part of, I think, what contributes to the continuing divide is, we could just say, I might call it sin, but some people would call what I do sin. So I get that. I get that. Okay. But our inability to hear the pain, because everybody, when you weed through all the rhetoric, there is a need that's not getting met. There's a sense that people feel marginalized. And even the people we might not have imagined that would feel marginalized. And I'm saying lower levels psychologically that are not manifest. So that is important. It's important to understand that perspective. And that's one of the ways that the Lord has just kind of cautioned me. And so I've been seeking to try to appreciate. And some of those folks that are my friends who have now taken different perspectives. Some of them are my very close friends. But others are people that might not think I want to talk to them. But you know what? They're my students. They're my friends. They're my neighbors. So we are here together praying for God's intervening redemptive work in the midst of all of this. Because if the Holy Spirit can lead us in how to be present with one another in a new way, but it's got to be a new way, radically new way.
Well, I want to ask the listeners who are listening in on this conversation to think about replaying the whole thing back to the beginning and hearing everything again that you just said, Alexis, because, I mean, you are exquisite to me in so many different ways. And the way that you are honest emotionally, intellectually, socially, racially, spiritually, interpersonally, I mean, the levels are many faceted. And the arc that you just painted, both from the personal triggering of Phil's film all the way through to this moment, is this arc of a personal journey, a national journey, a regional journey, an interpersonal journey, but also a historic journey, one that involves everything about who we are in Christ, but it also involves everything about who we are as embodied people in the world. It involves every dimension. And this is clearly at the very core of all of your work. So I'm not saying this to reflect back to you what you don't know or in the least, but I just want to underscore it for listeners, because if you could take in what I think Dr. Abernethy just has shared and then just let it replay and replay in your own mind, where is your story in this larger story that Dr. Abernethy just sketched? Because I think it's somehow stepping into other people's stories. And I want to affirm deeply the affirmation that you made about the importance of people really understanding their own narrative and their own pain. And certainly it is the case that asking people where the conversation can go in this direction, asking people what the center of their fear is that motivates their vision of the world that's around them, not everybody's prepared or even cognizant, frankly, that that's even happening. And if it is, they are not necessarily all that reflective about it. But at some place in their life, they know that there is a fear or fears that they're carrying in various ways, which are triggers in their own way and end up spawning so many other, sometimes apparently related or unrelated responses to that. But there it is. And wow, I mean, as the summer was going on and all of it was unfolding with such extraordinary energy, the largest racially related demonstrations probably in American history, apart from the totality of the Civil War, much, much, much bigger in size than the 60s Civil Rights Movement, much bigger than the numbers of peoples that actually attended those rallies, much more national, much less regional. All those things to me were quite heartening. I think it was heartening to me, frankly, that there was no single leader. There was no single voice. It was really, honestly, I look back on the summer and say it was just hundreds of voices. It was hundreds of voices of people at all kinds of different levels of public and private influence and of every race, and just a remarkable sense of kind of public galvanization. On the other hand, there was the response of people who saw all the same things I was watching, and saw it as a story of violence, of destruction, of an attempt to destroy America. Now, just exactly in the area you're describing, the people that saw it in that way primarily are people that I need to spend more time hearing from, understanding, trying to grapple with what they're seeing. I think from my perspective, the demonstrations were so 95% nonviolent. And yes, like any demonstrations, frankly, any gathering of human beings on the planet, there's always a percentage of trouble that will be stirred up as a result of that. But it was not, to me, it was not scary. It was profoundly hopeful because of so many people responding to it, and yet unresolved. So that brings us really to where we are. So we've had this hugely inflamed and visible and dramatic summer into the early fall. Nothing has, in the macro sense, changed. There are small changes that have been made in various police departments and various regional, county, and state governments around some elements of policy and practices that could really help to change the way that money is being used and so forth. But the fundamental battle is still absolutely with us about how do we reach racial justice, racial equity, racial inclusivity, racial diversity. And we are in a permanent change on the road to a date when the national population will no longer be predominantly white, when it will really be predominantly people of color, as it is in certain regions of the country already, but it will gradually become true throughout the country. That to me honestly sounds like really great news, but I know that not everybody does think it's great news. Meanwhile, there's a huge fatigue. I've heard you refer to it as just a kind of battle fatigue in the racial justice journey. Just talk a little bit about that. At this stage, you've come through the experience you've just described with this unbelievable 9 or 10 months that you've been going through this. What is that fatigue made of? What is that battle fatigue made of?
Okay. So first, I'll define it. And since I have a book readily available, Racial Battle Fatigue in Faculty.
Wow.
Okay. Yes. Perspectives. Yes. And Lessons from Higher Education. So this has just come out. So let me just read a definition, because the ways in which folks talk about this, this did build from Chester Pierce's work. And we know about him in the 70s. He coined the term microaggressions, but his chapter was actually on offensive mechanisms, and he was describing micro as well as macro aggressions. And it mainly, he's a psychiatrist, Harvard-trained psychiatrist, and so he was describing the health-related effects. So one way to describe this is a particular dimension of it. But it's William A. Smith who defined racial battle fatigue as encompassing physiological, psychological, and behavioral strain exacted on racially marginalized and stigmatized groups and the amount of energy they expend coping with and fighting against racism. So you see, you can think about microaggressions, macroaggressions being one piece, right? But this is adding when you are fighting, you're engaged in the fight. So what I have found, Mark, in the last 6 months or so, I'm losing track of time now, but since things were escalating more, what is the pull? So those of us who train, those of us who do DEI kinds of things,
you get drawn on more. You're being asked to do more in this season. So first, for myself, I didn't have the capacity. Just like I was a little bit missing in action for our typical conversation, you know, 4 days. Well, I have said no to people, and people have been frustrated with me because they know I'd normally be present. Now, there's this little thing called I do have a larger role at Fuller, too. So that happened in July. So I'm well aware that I need to keep capacity for that. So my work responsibility expanded, and then the world is exploding. And so I really had to be quite careful about my own self-care because I have been fatigued. Now, what that looks like for me is that I cannot watch too much on TV. I have not watched the whole George Floyd murder. I have not watched it. Just the beginning is I don't need to see it. I cannot. So I don't watch, and a lot of my colleagues say the same thing. We don't watch the whole thing. We just don't. Then we watch how much TV we take in. The retelling of it, the recurring piece. So I have to really monitor that. That means my phone too, because it's brought there. So I have to pace myself and extend grace to myself. Now, am I depressed? I would not say clinically depressed, but as we would say as Black folks, do I have the blues? Yes, I do. I've got moments where I've seriously got the blues. And I have to say, you know, there's this My Grandmother's Hands by Rezma Menakan, and I'm probably not pronouncing her name correctly, but racialized trauma and the pathway to mending our hearts and bodies. She actually lays down how the power of song, music, artistry, the things that you do to heal. So there was a period for several months that I was just silent. In terms of singing, I have sung in choirs, and because of COVID-19, I'm not singing now because I had both played the piano, studied the piano, and studied voice a little bit. You know, it's natural for me to be singing. The song has been muted in me for several months, and I was aware of it. I mean, I definitely wasn't playing the piano. I'd listen to music, but not humming, not singing. So my grandmother, someone says grandmother's hands. My grandmother lived with us 9 months out of the year, would be in the kitchen, and she had a hard life. School principal, but she also worked in white folks' homes as a maid. She would be singing and humming a spiritual, a hymn, and I gradually started to do that. Now, as I read this book, that's part of the healing. And I was telling other people actually to sing a song, right? But I knew it was part of the healing. I could not do it myself. And so it's not power of music. We understand that. But see, there's something. It doesn't matter whether you can carry a tune or not. A tune can come through you. That's what matters. And it bodily, physiologically, it redirects and heals some of that fatigue. It revives the soul. So that battle fatigue, that's part of what it looked like for me in some of the ways of moving through it. Well, what was I hearing in my colleagues? They were being asked many things. They needed permission to, okay, I can't do everything. I found myself coaching them to, no, you can't do everything. Well, what about our students? You know, it's great that many of our classes were focused towards some of these events, but think about, again, the students that experience a marginalization and racism, that's a greater toll. Oh, now I have to talk about this in class. With some people are just waking up to this, and I have to sit there in the midst of their sharing, it is such a burden. So, Mark, you know that there was a Black scholar strike. Was that in September? Where it just said, this day, don't ask Black scholars anything.
A national strike, that's right.
That was a real wonderful recognition. Look, we are called on in so many ways. And we need to take time out, not only for the day. Some people are taking adjusted schedules for the year. So what am I saying? Well, it might feel like, would you actually make an adjustment for a student in a class in this season? And what I'm saying, you have to balance the equity issues. But if you don't understand that there is a war going on, so, you know, the term is racial battle fatigue, but what this brought us, it's a war now. And in a war, my brothers are retired naval officers, the strategies for engagement are different. And so we have to recognize that, yes, you actually do need to consider making some adjustments, that a person might not be able to talk about it today. They might eventually be able to. Okay, right. If it's a conversation, have it be okay. Even give space. Some people are up for this today. Some may not be. Those who are not feeling ready today will provide this other opportunity. Those are the exact things that are so important. And I want to add this. I'm a group therapist as well, so I think about group dynamics. Some people have been warriors in this for a long time, so they've carried so much. Our revered John Lewis is such a wonderful example of that. But just people that we know in our lives, in our communities, in our families. Well, one way to think about this is we can help folks individually manage their racial battle fatigue, but we should also understand it as a systemic issue. The way the system works is that some people carry this and others do not. Group dynamics, energy dynamics says this needs to be more proportionate. So some people want to say, oh, let me help you manage this. That's great. That's helpful. But it is actually more important, let me own my stuff and do my work, because right. That's what's going to then make it we're in this together and feel more proportional.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. And that's partly what people mean when they say that people of color shouldn't bear the burden of teaching white people what is happening, right? That feels like it just adds yet another layer of burden, as opposed to white people going off in their own ways and reading and researching and finding the opportunity to learn in other ways, as opposed to laying that additional burden on people of color.
Exactly.
One of the things that I think is so profound about what you're describing is it demands a kind of attentiveness that can be itself very fatiguing, right? I mean, sometimes denial exists partly because it's a survival mechanism, right? It's easier to, at times, to sort of blow it off and try to just press on. We know that isn't a good strategy long term, but the idea of that is understandable. And the alternative of really making conscious, conceiving, letting yourself sit in the trauma, not as a pity party, but as just a full-on acknowledgement of what really has happened and the burden that you're carrying is such an important thing. What do allies do when we see friends of ours needing to sit in that space? And they are in many, many cases. But if we're a white person and we are in communities of color and we care deeply about friends in that setting, and we know that we're not trying to do their work nor avoid doing our own work, but just trying to be life-giving, what would you say to that?
Yes. Well, just as you've alluded to and I was mentioning, part of doing your work first is the reading list. And there's so many now. That's what, again, a beautiful thing. All these books are almost sold out, right? Because we often think about what we already know. This is a time for myself. I mean, I probably read 20 books related to these matters just since August. I mean, my summer reading, I found myself just devouring. It was a way of me healing too.
Right.
But you want to update yourself. So that's the first. Read some of the recent and sometimes classic things that have been written so that you have a deepened appreciation. Then I would say, connect with something that's experiential. So there's so many podcasts, there's so many things, because there's something about something that's not just on the written page, you hear it orally. Because as you connect with that, again, the bodily piece, you take something in new. So experience something that's like a frank conversation, depiction, film, so that you take that in. Okay, so what I'm basically saying is you need to prepare to be a stronger ally for your friend, because part of what's happening is your friend is taking in so much more. And if you want to be in a little more in the ballpark, you want to be in an active intake mode. There's something about being active with this, not passive, that helps you know how to be present. Okay?
Right.
But then, you know, and it so depends on the friendship and the nature of the relationship, right?
sometimes what I say, because this is, I will say, frankly, there's some people that I've been talking to and they're friends about some of these issues. And I've been talking for a good while. I guess they haven't been as fully listening. Maybe that I wasn't articulating this clearly, but actually that's less true. That can sometimes be true, but not in this case. So now they're hearing. Okay, so you know what I would say to people? Play that tape back. Remember what your friend has already told you. Because right. If you're friends, you've already heard it from that person. You actually have. And that's an important discipline, because I would say if you approach your friend and you're back at, you know, diversity issues or decolonization, whatever you want to call it, one-on-one, these days you might hear how much that ticks the friend off, right? Remember, what is this friend expressed? What is this friend concerned about? What has maybe even been talked about in your relationship? Has this friend been talking about structures and policies and procedures? Well, do some homework on that. Because see, there's an opportunity not only to engage relationally along these lines, but to actually mobilize to do something to make a difference. So I always say we need all kinds of soldiers in this battle, right? We need the foot soldiers that are going to get out there and march. You know, we need that. We also need the policy makers. So I would say prepare for the work. Imagine not what you want to do, because that's the thing. We want to help. So the way we often do that is say, how can I help you? Let's suspend that question. Let's think about what has our friend already told us would help. So even to enter there, you know, you've mentioned that this, is this something that could be helpful? And see, if you start there, then it's like, they'll say, actually, no, not this time, but this might be. That's a much better place. Because truthfully, if you ask me what will help, I'll say, where do I start?
And where have you been?
That's right. Exactly. So I would really cue all of that up. And again, that's what's publicly available now. Strategies, I mean, everything's laid out there.
I do think that that sense of breaking the sound barrier is what I call it. I think that white people exist on a side of the sound barrier that often makes many white people feel like, I dare not bring up issues of race. That would be awkward, as though I'm seeing you as a Black person. Whereas in actual fact, you are a Black person. Right. And that to bring it up is actually itself a gesture of connection, not of disconnection. Yes. Like, I see you for who you are in the world. I want to know you. I want to support you. I want to be with you. I want to listen if that's useful. I want to be an ally who joins in a long work, right? And it is amazing how many white people I know who stay frozen in a bubble of their own whiteness for fear that if they were to break the sound barrier and acknowledge race in their relationship, that it would cause offense. Yes. Whereas in fact, it's the exact opposite. To be able to break the sound barrier is to actually enter the real world where the Black person, for example, is already living every single day. Yes. It's not like you're creating a problem by raising the reality of what's already in the room. Yes. So do you want to interact with that idea?
Yes, I love this. I haven't heard you say that way, the sound barrier, but we talk to our students about, and these are second year clinical science students, but I go right for it now. I say, yes, you should bring up race in a contextualized way, different aspects of your culture in the first session. I tell them I do this no matter who my client is. Just to let them know that I've got the courage to address it if it's relevant. Then we try to remind folks that many people of color, it's race-based countertransference and transference, which means the feelings they have toward other people that look like you are often going to be present in the work. The question is, are you going to do anything about it? Are you going to work with it? So this sound barrier notion is interesting, because the way I would riff on that is that, okay, you're concerned about breaking the sound barrier. But the visual barrier, your bodily barrier, your sensation is already showing, even the touch barrier, the ways in which your nonverbals are already declaring that there's either discomfort or you're being particularly careful. And that's what's getting read. And we still have the problem that many people of color that go for therapy, they don't stay. It's a much shorter course. They end prematurely. So we're talking 2-3 sessions, you know? So that is problematic. So at least
if it's okay with you, I'm going to draw on that metaphor, but also say, maybe hesitant to address the sound, but the other dimensions are being communicated. And so really, by entering the sound barrier, you will have the ability to be more authentic. You don't have to be ready to deal with everything that comes up, but you can be authentic. Authenticity is a deeply held value for Black folks in particular. So that goes a long way.
Yeah, I've been amazed as a cue that some people might find helpful. I know this is less relevant now when we're not taking as many Uber cars, perhaps, as we might have in the past. But I think I've mentioned to you privately how fruitful it's been for me. Whenever I get into an Uber car, if I'm being driven by a person of color, I almost always bring up race as quickly as I can in the conversation. And I do it in this way. I'll say, you know, I'm a visitor here. I don't really know the layout of the city. I don't know kind of the dynamics of what it's like to live here. But what is it like as a person of color to live in this space? Now, that's a fairly direct question. I would probably not ask that if I was standing face to face with them, not as quickly. It's not the very first question, but it is a question that appears very shortly after it. Because what I really actually do want to talk about while they're driving me wherever I'm going is I actually want to hear them describe their life as a person of color in that city. Like, what are the issues? What are the challenges? How does it work here? I know some cities it's like this, but what is it like here, right? Very, very little prompting. I have done this literally hundreds of times, and I have never had a person be anything but immediately responsive to what I've said. So suddenly I'm learning in a way where they're in charge, they're driving, they're looking forward, they're in command of me. I'm not really in command of them. I'm in the back. I'm not looking straight at them. We might connect through the rearview mirror, but mostly really they're not looking at me either. So it's a very interesting, safe space for conversations about many things, but not least about race in a context where people are actually quite interested in talking about it. And I have learned a ton that has felt not, I think, like trying to get them to be my teacher. They're the person with insight. I need your wisdom to help me navigate this town, which I try to make it quite specific to the place, which I'm not usually from. Does that surprise you or not surprise you that people would be so ready to speak?
No, it doesn't surprise. I remember when I asked the Kenyan cab driver, you know, I got some of the best insight about this before the tribal conflict started. No,
we completely.
You know, it's like, this is new.
Exactly.
But still, I do understand that. But I think one of the very important differences is you are asking them about their experience. It sounds like, tell me about your cultural values or something like that. That would feel more of a kind of didactic, but you're giving a window. And then I think even in your sharing that, there's a way in which you can engage in your visit there. That's what also seems even respectful about that, that you could engage there with that in mind. So it actually informs how you engage your visit and others there in that time.
Right.
To where you take away. So, I think that.
Well, I think for me, what it has been is just proof of what I had learned before, but it's so massively evident to me now is how eager people of color under the right circumstances, where it's not an inquisition and I'm not asking them to defend anything. I'm just wanting them to share their experience and I will share whatever experiences I might have seen or understood as well. But in that context, there's just an immediate eagerness of a connectedness, right? I'm not standing away from their life. I'm not pretending that they aren't the person that they are in the car as we're driving to wherever I need to go, right?
Right.
And it has just felt like it's not only changed then those moments, but so many other moments where as a white person, I might have in the past been prone not to really ask questions in a way that I would have wanted to personally, because I would have been less assured that there was necessarily a receptivity to that. But in actual fact, I've found at least there's almost a continuous receptivity to
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And one thing I'd add, so if that was a time, a period when I'm experiencing racial battle fatigue, I might not have energy to answer.
Right. Absolutely.
Really not. Totally. And so that's the thing to just factor in. But in other cases, the fact it conveys interest, it conveys an understanding that there may be particular richness to the experience. All of those things can be communicated interpersonally in your interest.
And I do try to respond by saying, you know, I realize some of this is just stuff that you may not want to talk about, and that's fine.
Right.
But I have yet to have anybody
I hear you.
Do that.
I hear you.
So it's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. Alexis, this has been such an important conversation. And I just want to end by asking, if you want to speak to people of color, if you want to speak to people who are Black, if you want to speak to people who are white, with some kind of parting word of encouragement or whatever you would like to offer, I'd love us to be able to hear and receive that.
Okay, thank you for that. And I've appreciated this time. Well, you know, something that just comes to mind for me, one of the books I have is by John Lewis, so I'm looking forward. I haven't read that, peeked through it. And it meant so much. Think about this, such a warrior for our country in his dying days, and he knew he was dying. What does he do? He comes to DC and stands on Black Lives Matter Plaza. And basically, I'm hearing him say, it is well with my soul. Now, that is not because things are where they need to be, but he saw the next generation's chapter mobilization on a level unprecedented, as we've talked about. So when the elder has plenty good room for the next manifestation. I'm talking, I don't like to see myself as an elder, but I guess the gray hair tells a story. As elders, we need to make room for the new energy, creative energy, all of that that is coming, and work together. That's what standing there so much meant. Work together to push forward now with what is before us. And with God's help, and to know, you know, how John Lewis, he, you know, those people he could have never forgiven, always resented, he didn't do that. He forgave, but was focused on justice, focused on justice. So he's such a powerful witness to me, the recent one. So I would lift that up. I think that inspires me and part of what we need to keep in mind.
Amen. Dr. Abernathy, thank you so much for the next chapter that this has been in our ongoing conversations. And thank you again so much for the friend, the teacher, the ally, the encourager, the challenger that you are within the context of Fuller, and the way that you're helping to really remake Fuller. And your leadership is indispensable to what we're doing, and who you are and how you do it is itself the story of what Fuller needs to become. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, President Labberton.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.